Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Tech Can't Save Us. As always, I'm one of your co-hosts, William Gadsby Pete.
And I'm Sabina Serrano.
And I am Paul David. Good to be back in the studio.
Back in the studio, calling in from Amsterdam in a wonderful tech meet and greet, I believe you are at.
Yeah, we're meeting with some different tech brands at Soho House here in Amsterdam. And first day meetings have been good so far.
Awesome. Paul has literally flown back from America yesterday to go straight to Amsterdam and has still managed to fit us into podcasting. So, you know, it's props to Paul for making it for the pod.
Yeah, shout out to Liz, our business development manager, who definitely had to call the hotel to wake me up this morning because I was so jet lagged. So, but I made it up. Made it on time. Thanks.
We love you, Liz. Awesome. We've got a great pod today and very, very happy to have Paul on because we're talking about a subject that's near and dear to both of our hearts, which is user experience. So it's something that often gets overlooked in the world of tech and actually the world of marketing as well. Something we run into often with the work we do at Literal Humans. So yeah, excited for this one. How are you all feeling about user experience in the podcast studio?
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting topic. So with Identity 2.0, which is the creative studio I run, my co-founder is actually a UX designer, Ardara Weiss. So constantly hearing from her all sorts of horror stories, but also trying to embed that in our creative practice in different ways. So I think there's a lot you can learn from the way you conduct UX experiences and like embed it in different parts of different industries and different sort of products that you're building, whether they're creative or whether that's an app.
Before we jump into some of the topics, Paul, maybe if you want to just give like a kind of summary of what user experience is, just in case any of our audience haven't heard.
Yeah, I just came off of arguably one of the worst user experiences ever at Burning Man, so maybe I'm the right person to talk about this. Yeah, I mean, I understand user experience as sort of how the end user, the end human, is experiencing the product and their journey through it. So usually we think of that in sort of a visual sense, like in terms of a user's journey through a website, for example, or at least how a like a physical product or a digital product lands in their hands or in their eyes and just how it gets experienced by them.
It's kind of almost hard to pin down, but the user experience, designing a product so that the people that it's aimed at actually find it easy to use and it solves problems as quickly and efficiently as possible. And there's also kind of like UX and user research, which is just like, hey, you think that your target audience is X and you think that they have this problem Y. Are you accurate in that? Because quite often you're not. And so should we actually be designing a totally different product?
And I think a lot of it borrows from 2000 to 2000, probably around 15, the hype of data and the importance of having data-backed science. And that's what's going to lead you to having great insights. But I think UX bridges quite nicely that need for data, but also the kind of bringing it back to the person. So it combines qualitative and quantitative research in like kind of one discipline.
No, yeah, it takes us really nicely onto our first topic, which is just looking at the shift in customer experience and tech and how like that has kind of really defined user experience. When we talk to Dan and Alex from Everything is a User Experience, couldn't find a more aptly named organization to have on this pod. They talk about UX used to just be called good design, and it's basically the sort of last 20 to 30 years of the internet that's pushed it forward. Yeah, in that article, it kind of looks at the article we read before for this is like, what were the driving forces behind the creation of UX, and how do you actually offer experiences in tech that don't sort of just fall in love with tech itself or the platform?
One of the things I appreciate from their article is like they discussed this idea of like a capability gap, and just like closing that between what customers expect or what they understand and what you're ultimately delivering to them or what the ultimate experience is. I think that's really important. You know, we think about that in the service side of things when it's like, hey, what is this client thinking and expecting to get from us? And then what are we delivering them at the end of the month or the end of the quarter?
I think that's probably why it's so important to have user experience at the start of like a company's journey as well, because so often, you know, founders are tied to a certain solution when they should be really focused on the problem, and UX brings it back to that problem and brings them possibly new solutions to what, you know, they can do to tackle that problem. And that's why I think UX is really foundational to like any startup journey and making sure that it's embedded across whatever product or services that you're trying to roll out, because that's going to essentially design anything that you're building first. And you know, as a founder, you should be tied to your problem. That's what you're trying to do, and whatever solution is that arises out of what your audience needs, that's then what you'd then go and pursue, not necessarily the other way around.
Yeah, and I think people get quite like, especially in smaller businesses and startups, they can get a little put off by UX because it's like you think of UX as this incredibly complicated situation where you speak to 50 people, you do this really structured scientific interview approach. And like, oh, you can do that, you know, like for a massive transnational company, that is the approach. But really just actually understanding what your customers' pain points are, like, and like always having them front of mind when designing solutions is what you're talking about. Like, that's at the heart of UX. So, you know, just spending half a day on the sales desk if you have one, or on the even better on the customer service desk if you have one, to truly understand like the pain points of your product and what they're solving and what they're not solving. It can be as simple as that, rather than worrying about like, oh, I don't understand this incredibly scientific approach that involves all of these like really nuanced interview strategies. Like, just understand your customers and then translate their needs into a good product and good new roadmap for new features.
Yeah, I feel like with stuff like design and UX, words like frictionless and flexible get kind of thrown around really easily, and it's like, okay, what do we really mean by this? And I appreciate it in the HBR piece, they talked about not all digital experiences need to be frictionless. And they had, you know, in the Gartner study, they talked about that, like with like B2B and B2C customers, that if they realize something new about their own needs and their own goals, they were 1.73 times more likely to buy more. So that's really interesting, because it's not as simple as like, hey, this needs to be a frictionless journey towards them buying something. There's some value in some friction, because in that friction, there's learning, there's growth, there's the consumer learning something about themselves or what they're searching for that they didn't realize before. So I think that's like a really important aspect of UX, is like, to what degree is it frictionless or frictionful towards whatever goal you're working for with the customer.
And I think it's in that friction you can find innovation as well, because you're forced to think of different ways of doing it, of producing this journey, of like putting stops or pause breaks as well. And that's the exciting things. That's where like innovation happens, and you're able to be a bit more creative and do something that sets you apart from your competitors.
And we think about that in the marketing context too. We look at like dwell time. Like, dwell time is a good thing, you know, in many cases in the context. And then when you even look at like proposals, like there are tools like pitch.com, and you can look at analytics and see where people pause within a proposal and understand, okay, maybe they learned something, maybe they really focus on this, maybe they thought deeply about this aspect of their proposal.
Yeah, it's truly understanding metrics rather than just hearing the quicker the checkout time, the better, and therefore we're going for that. And that's fine if you're an e-commerce store selling sort of like impulse buys. If you're selling a £2,000 luxury watch, you need a totally different checkout process. But if you don't involve UX and just chase the sort of like general e-commerce wisdom, you know, you end up screwing yourself over. And I do think to that point, like the last thing I'd say that UX has like at its very heart is open-mindedness, like the ability to hear from your customers, from your internal team, and change course. And I think like, whether it's a bad marketing, a bad product, one of the things that is most common is always consistent throughout any like bad UX experience is you have one senior stakeholder that has decided things are the way they are, won't listen to any reason, and sort of bends the world around them and is like, no, we are going to deliver this product that I understand solves the needs, and won't listen to anyone else. When like, dude, all of our customers are saying differently, no one is using Facebook anymore, why are we doing an ad campaign on there? You have to have that open-mindedness to change your opinion based on the reality.
Yeah, so I think we've set a good baseline here for, you know, our understanding of UX and all the ways that it can and cannot work for your organization. But I'm really excited to talk about where it can go. What is the future of UX and what it could look like for different industries when we're seeing the rise of all sorts of different technologies, such as augmented reality? You know, we've got the AI rise as well. How is that going to reshape and, you know, revolutionize the user experience landscape?
Yeah, I think there's a lot out there that is concerning and exciting at the same time. It's always the case with tech, like, you know, there's a lot of people just creating shit, and that will always be the case. Where I think we are seeing truly interesting emerging technologies, and again, it gets to this kind of core of like, am I solving a real problem? Am I really fulfilling a real need? So a great example of sort of the future of tech, which I think speaks to a good UX, is VR experiences, using them to train up incredibly high skill and important professions. So something like, if you're a heart surgeon, being able to put on a VR headset and watch a heart surgeon with 30 years experience conduct an operation and interact with that operation yourself from a first person perspective massively improves the quality of that training, decreases the amount of patients that die as a junior doctor gets upskilled on how to do surgery. You know, that is just a ticks all the boxes, and also makes that training more accessible. And that's the good use of VR technology to truly give an experience that you wouldn't have been able to have until VR technology was invented.
I think one of the most exciting things for me from the side of UX and looking at AI and the impact of data analytics is the opportunity to personalize at scale. I think like people are going to be awash in more and more generalized AI generated content that doesn't speak to them specifically. So the need for that will just increase. I was just having an interesting conversation with Maddie from Just Eat today. And we were talking about how companies like Just Eat are thinking about not just like delivering meals to people, which is, you know, baseline. And I think it's one of the most amazing innovations out there in tech, but like, how do you think about it as an experience and how do you layer onto it? Right. So now you're looking at some of these tools and they're like, okay, Paul's having a meal. Let's also offer him 15 minutes to remind him that he can get a discount on his groceries after he's just ordered his meal. And that works. I do that on Deliveroo. It happens, you know, but what if they dug into the data and they realized that like, every night, you know, not every night, but every weeknight, Paul likes to put on a movie. Usually that movie is like a mystery or thriller or something like that. He likes to have a glass of wine. How do they make sure I'm stocked up on that glass of wine? They know that I like to have a curry. How do they make sure that I'm stocked up on that curry? You know, how are they like layering in these other bits of experience into that thing I'm already doing using their platform? It gets a little scary. It gets a little big brother, but I think that's really interesting in terms of like, that's the road we're going down with being able to personalize at scale and just like really digging in the analytics, really understanding customers on a deep level, and then feeding that into the product and making sure it's being pushed over to them, delivered to them.
To Paul's point, being able to say to your Alexa, hey, Alexa, order me 3 bottles of wine that I'd like, and have all of the ability and algorithm set up, or more like menial tasking, just being like, hey, Alexa, we're out of milk, order it, or, you know, order my usual shopping list, that kind of thing. Because at the moment, voice assistants are not that useful, but I feel like that combined with AI is really the innovation they were looking for the ability to do that personalization at scale, where they're genuinely like a little butler or personal assistant to your life, rather than just a really frustrating, no, Alexa, not that song. No, Alexa, not that song. God damn it, Alexa, why do you hate me?
It's exciting when you really play it out. How many times have you, I'll just speak for myself, I've sat there a number of times and been like, I don't have the hummus that I want with my chips tonight. And like, it's the last thing on my agenda after a long Wednesday or something like that. And to some extent, we have the tools to take care of that. You know, we could have a smart fridge that measures the amount of hummus, that calculates the huge amount of hummus that I eat when it's a bag of chips, and then orders it for me, and then it's delivered. And it knows, you know, after last night's binge on hummus, that I'm going to need some new hummus for tonight's movie. And it just does that for me. And it knows what flavor I like. It knows all that stuff. Yeah.
And I think that's where it comes back to like where the friction is in the user journey. So if it's like, okay, you want your fridge to be able to order all that, but Paul, you want a bit of a pause and a break of like, okay, we know you want all this, but maybe there's other ways of doing it as well. So how are those user journeys different depending on what the audiences are? And I think that's where the friction needs to come in to be basically make sure that people feel like this isn't just like some automation taking over their life completely, but you know, there's points where there's choice, there's consent, like all of this is considered into it. And it isn't just a automation of your life. And I think that's why user journey is really important, because it makes it feel like people are active in this. So it isn't just done to them, it's done with them.
Hmm. Yeah, one of the points in the Forbes piece was like creating flexibility in UX through no code. So that like if you're using a no code baseline, then customers can basically go in there and customize the UX at a moment's notice. I think that's really interesting. It's like, what's that feedback loop from the customer to like, hey, I want to customize this UX for my experience and maybe not have to go through the entity or the company or a developer to do it.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see like how the future of UX-based thinking applies to like the creative industry as well. Like what AR and VR looks like for the museums, for like art galleries and different ways. Like I think we started to explore it a little bit during lockdown, but I think the learning curve was so steep and the technology was quite hard to access. And so we're kind of getting there with spaces like Mozilla Spaces and hubs that they set up, which is like open and free to explore. And like Microsoft have their own little VR spaces that kids can explore in as well. But I think that there's so much innovation and fun things that could be happening there around how you improve in-person experiences of cultural moments using technology to supplement it and to expand on it as well. I think that's going to be such an interesting area that technology can be applied to enhance it, really.
Also, like more interface options. I thought that was one of the more interesting pieces in the first piece was like more speech and visual interface options. So like, what do people who are hard of hearing or, you know, don't have the ability to speak, how do they engage with voice assistants? How to use them, you know? So like there's things that like facial recognition you can do, or just like other ways of engaging, maybe kinesthetic means of engaging with these assistants. And that's all part of UI and UX. It's sort of like, how do we broaden you know, UX has become very prescriptive, which does mean now that UI interfaces are just sort of doing things for people. But how do we leverage that in a way to help people who have different abilities and are set up differently to expand that universe to them? I think that's an interesting, and I don't hear that get talked about a lot in UX, UI. There's a bit about like colors and accessibility around that and vision and stuff, but not UX as a tool for, and UI for a tool, as a tool for accessibility.
No, 100%. Like the way that you make a website accessible is you follow the WCAG guidelines and it's all very prescriptive. But like what something we've seen a little bit is like a plugin that kind of lets a user with visual impairment versus a user with an audio impairment choose how they use the website and change how their experience with the website. And to Paul's point, what I think is a very exciting thing that we already have the technology for, and there may well be someone who's already put this together and we just don't know about it. But what you could absolutely do is get a user who has some form of visual impairment or something like, you know, ADD, where they just have, they process information differently, and their algorithm from their browser could be learning how they interact with the internet and then making information easier for them to consume based on their specific type of ADD. Because, you know, that's one of the problems with it. You get lumped into, okay, you have this one thing and all of the people within that react the same way, but within that there's so many sub niches of like basically everyone's unique, and just one way your brain being wired slightly differently does not mean that it's all the people are wired slightly differently the same way. So yeah, it's like, how do you get those algorithms to actually train up individual software for one user so that every website they load up is perfectly crafted to their specific visual impairment, their specific audio impairment, or whatever it might be, which is a really cool and exciting place to be. And yeah, the exact opposite of much of the sort of cookie cutter crap we see on the internet nowadays.
And I think that brings us really nicely, because we're going to be talking to two experts in the field. We're going to be talking to Dan and Alex, who are founders of Everything is UX, who really focus on this idea of, you know, how do we make sure that we're thinking of the users first? How are we embedded them into the entire process, and how do we expand our understanding of who a user is and who a stakeholder is? And so yeah, that will be coming up next.
Yeah, and I think the exciting thing about that paper is we're actually taking the time to interview folks who have been involved in the briefing process on the agency side, on the brand side, and to the point of working with EI UX is to just interview them and get their experiences and their understanding of how they've seen briefing processes go really well, how the pre-brief, you know, even thinking about the problem you're facing as a brand or as an agency gets done. So it's something we've been talking to a lot of, you know, clients and folks in the sector about. And yeah, very excited to put together that white paper.
Yeah, check it out. It'll be coming into your inbox soon. And now here's Alex and Dan. We're joined by Dan Hyde and Alex Blondin. Have I pronounced your second name correctly?
Absolutely.
Fucking nailed it.
Well, do you want to try it with a French accent, maybe?
But we are joined by Dan Hyde and Alex Blondin.
Very good.
Very happy to be joined by Dan Hyde and Alex Blondin, the founders of Everything is User Experience. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, cheers for having us.
Before we jump into a rip-roaring conversation about all things user experience, would love for you to just give us a quick overview of you guys. What is EI UX, as we refer to it in shorthand? Everything is User Experience. And yeah, what do you do and why is it cool?
We never call it EI UX. Like, just as a point of... Well, we did it first, but we realized that betrayed a lack of confidence. One of the central propositions of the brand, I mean, it's in the name, isn't it? Everything is user experience. And secondary to that, like, we work in France as well, which if you use the initial letters, it becomes impossible to say in French.
E-U-X. Just, no, it doesn't work.
Yeah. So in terms of user experience, it's appalling.
I mean, to be fair, saying everything is user experience in French doesn't work much better either. It would be something like, tout est l'expérience utilisateur, and it just doesn't flow. Everything is user experience flows really, really nicely in English. Yeah. So we're going to have to stick to that and maybe find a different version when we expand properly to France, I think.
It's also one of those brilliant names. We know everything is user experience from one of the other agency networks we're a part of, and me and Alex were having a beer and a networking event, and we're like, oh my god, it just makes sense, because everything is user experience. It's just like such a light bulb moment that other agency owners get. Like,
yeah, exactly.
And yeah, just maybe give a quick overview for maybe some of our listeners who might not be completely in the world of UX. Like, what is it? What is it you guys do, like, broadly? I know it's a very broad scope, but what is the purpose of Everything is User Experience?
Well, the way I put it, and so we have the beauty of how we work together with Dan is that we have different ways of looking at things, very, very similar on many things, but also different visions, which is why we enjoy working together. So I'll give my vision and then Dan can give his slightly different vision. And I might get it absolutely right. And we can completely agree or completely disagree as well.
Well, as with user experience development, getting things wrong is part of the process.
So a simple way I put it is that we do UX not for websites. So in a sense, we have a bit of a mission. We believe that the term user experience, and even worse, UX, has been completely taken over by the world of tech, which is why we're here talking about it today. And we believe fundamentally that it's about the people. And so all the methodologies that we use, you know, talking about journey mapping, wireframing, etc., is great and really, really important. But that's just the output. The first part of it is understanding users, audiences, human behavior, and understanding how then to create products, systems, or services that work for them. So in very simple terms, we are here to do audience research, we call it deep research, using UX methodologies that we're all familiar with from the tech world, and then giving back some ideas as to how we create product systems or services that actually work and function for the different audiences, because we're all quite different. And I know it's important to try and create things for the masses. Obviously, some companies are trying to do things with hundreds, if not millions, of people. But it's really important to bring it back to human behavior, human emotion, and stories as well. And we turn that into strategies and recommendations for our different clients.
User experience is a rebrand of good design. That's it. And it grew up in the post.com revolution, like Web 2, where mobile web became more of an issue, the gradual transition to mobile first everything or responsive everything. And in order to deliver a better experience, because up until that point, everyone was used to a crappy experience, and on a mobile, an even crappier experience, it became a saleable discipline within design, which the way Alex and I came about it, he used to be head of digital at another agency. I used to be head of the account team, and we collaborated on a bunch of projects for fairly big beasts. For these guys, we were working on all sorts of projects. So some very tech-focused projects for big beasts like JP Morgan, to smaller projects like websites for little hedge funds, some massive hedge funds that had very small presences who didn't care about user experience because that wasn't part of it. And from the experience of working on these websites in particular, where we hired in specialists because we were relatively ill-experienced at that point. In spite of Alex's years of experience, he'd not delved into UX as a pure discipline. We learnt loads. And you realise you're doing these things all the time if you're doing a good job. I started applying the things that I learned to branding and messaging strategy and campaign planning. Because like on the projects that we'd been working on, in particular websites, we were delivered briefs and we'd meet the brief. The client wanted super-powered, all-encompassing website, like a thing that could do everything for everyone. But what we kept coming up against was when we delivered these super powerful websites, there was no one client side to run them. They didn't have the expertise in-house, or they didn't want to invest in the training. The person who picked up the project would move on. And so often you'd see these projects wither on the vine. Like a successful launch, which didn't look like a success 12 months later. And that felt analogous to a bunch of the campaign stuff that we'd be doing. So through having conversations about this relentlessly, like all enthused with what we'd learned and how we could apply it, that's how we landed on the proposition that everything is user experience. Because we weren't focused on just end users, we were focused on the people within the organizations.
Well, I think that was a bit the sort of the light bulb moment, exactly as Dan was saying, we work on these projects. And when we first started just, you know, responding to demand, great, yeah, got it out there, got the invoice out, and thank you very much, and then you never saw the client again. Whereas when we started talking to people, really asking those questions, already going in to see a client and knowing that there was going to be some politics involved, that people will be looking at you going, nodding, you know, very wisely, but they don't know it, they've got no idea what you're talking about. So actually being able to understand who they are, what they want, what they need, what their own pain points are internally, even before you go out there and talk to the actual users of this website or the campaign or whatever, it really just suddenly transformed the way we were thinking about projects. And it's true that not only was it much more fun to do, but you ended up delivering something that actually worked in a much more long term. So that's why we decided to say, right, let's stop doing it within this agency that wanted to do other things just for financial services. Let's do the pure user experience, if you like. And that's why we're here today, really, is because that's what we focus on. And we found that because we also, it's been about 6 months now, we've repositioned ourselves. We're working with agencies because we found that a lot of agencies don't do that either. They are still at the beck and call sometimes of the client, who just expects to say, here's my brief, just go ahead and do it. I know all my users, you know, don't forget my employees. It doesn't matter. I'm exaggerating a bit, obviously, but it's amazing how often the actual real traditional, well, not traditional, but the user experience, the real, like, who are audiences, what do they want, what do they need, and what their pain points are, completely ignored. And we just go and build these fantastic products or technologies, only to find out that after many months of work and lots of money, they don't work because no one wants it. So what's the point? So now our job, I suppose, is to go and talk to people, get those stories out, bring them onto the table so that we can make informed decisions as to why are we doing this product, this system, or this service. And what does it need to achieve?
Yeah, I think it kind of speaks to that much reported on phenomena in Silicon Valley, where it's just like everything developed here applies to a 35-year-old white man, because that's who develops everything in Silicon Valley. And you're like, why the fuck do we just keep getting faster takeaway? And it's like, because that's what really matters to a developer who's working in that job. Speaking to some of the importance of the work you do, we'd love to hear like maybe one horror story from where UX has not been considered in over your work over the years, and then one success story from where someone has considered UX and then it's filtered through to over successful products. I know we've had some fun conversations over knowing each other about horror stories and also successes.
All right, in terms of horror stories, there are a couple. Been obviously the work that we do is immensely successful in almost all instances, so I'm only able to refer to some lost business. But we were asked to pitch, this is when we first started out, we were asked to pitch for UX strategy for a website redesign for a coffee roaster. So we're friends with an impact VC firm. For them, we do one day a quarter, we do UX workshops for the next cohort on their accelerator. So it's all impact-focused startups. And this was one of the post-first seed investment businesses that was upgrading what they did. They do shop face-to-face retail sales in their roastery, but mainly their business, as they perceived it, was subscription sales to corporations. And brilliant coffee, like serious business. They know their stuff. They're very impact focused. So I think they employ former prisoners. I don't know what the appropriate way, it seems demeaning to say ex-cons. It sounds a bit too porridge, but
I don't think anyone's probably figured out the right language.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of them. And this is the user experience of language itself, the original technology. Yeah, so we pitched for them, gave them what we felt was quite a reasonable proposal. We explained that every proposal, first draft, is a prototype. We don't actually know what you want. We know what you've told us you want, but that's just your version of the brief. No one's interrogated the brief, and we've no idea if you've got it right even. And so, you know, it's a negotiation process, conceptually, not just over haggling over pennies. We submitted the proposal, strategy session, workshop, then follow up with interviews to deliver full-blown UX strategy to last them 3 years. We never heard from them again. And this is friends of friends, so you would expect like some sort of... Anyway, we're friends with the designer they worked with, and they didn't want to pay for it, so they decided just do it in-house. Like, we'll just work with our designer. Now, UX design, UX strategy, and user interface design, they're all quite different disciplines. They're definitely not the same thing. It is a rare beast, and we know a couple who can do it all. But they are few and far between. Anyway, they ended up wanting to set themselves apart in the coffee space, because you can imagine it's a commodity product, it's quite crowded. And so they did this really fantastically complicated user interface, which, on the terms of the brief, something different. Perfect. So we were on the quiet, we were asked to crit the work. And like, what was the brief? So they told us the brief. And like, love it. I hate sideways scrolling websites normally, but this was lovely. Like, it was interesting. However, once it was launched, subscription sales dropped massively, and they lost, as a consequence, hundreds of thousands of pounds in revenue, because people were landing on the homepage, couldn't work out how to get to the shop to buy the coffee. So they bounced and went to the next coffee website, because, you know, everyone's got two or three places to buy from.
And the company, it took them, I think it was three different other agencies who kept saying, the problem is not what you're trying to get us to do, it's the website. And it took them three of those conversations over many, many months before they went, okay, maybe this thing that we absolutely love, that we think is the best thing since sliced bread, could be our problem. Mm. And well, then they changed it, and then things obviously got a lot better.
Yeah, they thought the problem was marketing.
From a marketing agency, I can tell you, everyone always thinks the fucking problem's marketing. I that's really funny. And to be fair, like if I landed on a e-com store trying to buy myself coffee, I would not think to myself, well, this is probably a sideways scrolling website. Like, it's the last fucking thing I would think.
Well, yeah. But I mean, that really, it really set them back. I mean, they're doing really well now, but it took them a long time to get there. All they had to do was pick up the phone.
Mm.
Oh, well.
Yeah, it feels like this interplay between internal, external stakeholders. That's what you're talking about here in terms of the focus has to be on like the whole ecosystem of everyone who uses it. So even addressing the potential egos of the people who are building it as well. 100%. Like that's part of the process of what you guys are doing.
Well, as Dan put it earlier, getting things wrong is part of the process. Mm. And it really is funny because we use this with new clients and it really shocks them because you're supposed to say no. Of course, we have all the answers. And we go in going, well, we don't know. What do you mean you don't know? Well, our job is to go and find out. And when you've got the client coming up to you and saying, well, look, I've been doing this for 30 years and you know, I've been working with clients all my life and I know what they're like and I do this and my staff, I do this and that. And then obviously the ones who want to do it, obviously very open-minded, but everyone has got a bias somewhere, right? So you go and then do the research and then you go back to them and you show them what they thought versus what their staff or customers think and how different it is. And they're always amazed. It's just pretty much always the case. I think there was only one client. Well, no, it wasn't a client because we said to him we didn't have any work to do for him. It was just so good. Remember the platform? It was in the energy space, sustainability space. He created this lovely, amazing platform that was able to get data from I don't know where, and he was just taking us through the process, and he had thought all his audiences, everyone who could possibly use it, just the what I call traditional UX, the UI, the way that everything was positioned, the content hierarchy was perfect. He just thought through everything, and he was just clearly a polymath who just knew how to do everything, because he's the one who directed everything, and he just did not need that. But most organizations just go in and have these horrible biases and think that that's okay, that you can just go in and it's your gut feel, it's your experience. But there is nothing wrong with asking questions and challenging your own preconceptions. It's really important, and I think that is the heart of user experience. It's not the wireframes, if you like.
And every senior stakeholder secretly thinks they're a polymath. Like, every senior stakeholder's like, no, trust me, I'm fucking Rain Man when it comes to marketing. Exactly. We have this as well, like, but it's much, much smaller scale, like, but it shows how universal it is, where someone comes like, hey, I've got 200 grand to spend on Facebook. And you're like, why? Why the fuck would you do that? Give me 200 grand, I'll throw 150 of it down a well, and then I'll spend the other 50 on other platforms. It'll have the same outcome.
Or the people come and say, I need an app.
Yeah.
Why? Why?
Well, because all my friends at the club told me I need an app. Okay, but why? Well, because that's what people told me.
But this is it. Like, in many ways, when it comes to technology, we are Luddites. But in the true sense of the term, not the myth.
Yeah.
Like, you know, pro-technology, where the technology serves people. So one of our clients, an agency we partner with is based in Sydney. They're healthcare-focused, and we partner with them on a patient support program for patients with peripheral neuropathic pain. So an amazing treatment, non-systemic, which means it's not a pill, it's a treatment. So people who've got pain in their skin or pain on the exterior of them, they take capsaicin, so the hot part out of chilies, paint it on, like it's so fire, like it'd blind you if it got near your eyes. It's serious, like a surgical treatment procedure. And they wanted an app, first off, and through the investigation of the sort of user types, etc., what quickly became apparent is not everyone has a smartphone capable of running an app. Everyone has a phone, though. So why not just use SMS? Like, what do you need the app for? Even if it's just a wrapper, like with a standard HTML page sitting within it, like, what's the point? Just have a website and send them text messages to get them to go to a website. No one needs the icon on the home screen.
Yeah, I think sometimes you see the problem and people think like the most advanced tech will be the most advanced solution, but that's not always the case if it's not with your users. So how do you approach that with people when they do come and say, we definitely need the app, but your solution is maybe more low tech or like a lower barrier to entry than they maybe expect?
I think it comes back down to storytelling. It really is, because as humans, a story is the best way we can communicate things, because otherwise, you know, just try and give data and things like that. Yeah, so what? Apart from the few data scientists who know what they're talking about. But one example that comes to mind when you ask that question is that it wasn't a client, but we work a lot in the built environment. And in there's a whole part of the user experience of a home and how you use it. And there are certain families, from which country was the example, the one where the parents refuse to speak English because culturally they don't want to. Anyway, it doesn't really matter, but it's so families, let's say families in the UK who come from a different country, they haven't learned the language. They rely on their community and more importantly on their children. So basically, they've got these young kids who know how to use the phones and everything like that, all the knobs on the walls and everything like that. And that's great. So as they go, they grow up, the kids are always there. They can do all the translation. They can do everything. And the parents just say, do this for me. What happens when the children become adults and they move out? Well, suddenly you have a whole generation of people who are old, who don't get out of the house, don't speak the language, don't know how to use the system, and they're completely alienated. So it's really important to give those examples and say, this, you think that you've got this great solution that might be suitable for you or that 35-year-old white male, but actually you've completely forgotten to consider all the different cultures, all the different ethnicities and their different ways of living, and it's just not the same. So are you sure that this great idea that you've had is going to work for all these people that you think it's going to be there for? And often the answer is probably not.
It's so funny you say that. We're literally working with a client at the moment who is almost, it's an app aimed at exactly those folk in the States, mainly the elder immigrant families with Spanish as their first language. And yeah, we were like, it's cool actually, because they do understand who their audience is. And they were like, is there any way we could reach these people on social? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. An Instagram campaign aimed at their kids. That's how you get through to them. And then when you get face to face with those families, you better have fucking collateral. You better have physical things to hand over to them in both Spanish and English. And they built their app as a web app that you just need to put a URL in for any device. Like, just genuinely understanding the needs. It's cool when you see it done well, like how different the approach is. Like, it, most people would go, oh sweet, we'll do a dank TikTok strategy to get to these 70-year-old Latinos. Yes. And they're like, no, that's not gonna work.
But this is it. Different people need different things, and you have to drill down into, like, you can operate at a high level, like a paradigm, or you can develop archetypes, but until you understand the actual experience. So UX has evolved now. It's not just UX for everything. It's customer experience is everything. Customer experience 10 years ago was called design thinking, if you remember. And prior to that, good design, whatever. You know, it's all cyclical, because you can turn it into more money. So counter to what Alex said, in terms of convincing them to go for a lower technology solution, often you just tell them it's cheaper.
Mm.
Like, it'll be easier to produce. We were working with a DNA-driven plant-based nutrition app. That's what she wanted. So you do a 23andMe DNA test, then her algorithm, a series of Google Sheets, takes that data and produces an output that she turns into a personalized report for you. Based on the markers, it indicates how you're likely to take on or require nutrition, how you're likely to be able to take it on, all sorts of like amazing stuff. She wanted it to be an app, another one. But we did the research. We designed a research program. She couldn't afford to get us to do the research for her, so we designed a program that she could run herself, and we would do the analysis. This is another startup. I mean, what came out of that was, oh God, you barely need a website. Like, keep to your Google Sheets. We costed up how to develop that into a proper database with an online front end, all the bits that we would need to, but at the end of the day, it was like, you just need to do face-to-face meetings, a Slack channel, and send them a PDF. That's all people want, because that's all that they needed. You know, it was a runner who wanted to optimize their nutrition for racing. Pregnant women, seeing this is an instance where we're able to dig down into archetypes that would support her business at the stage it was at. Runners, pregnant women, generic people who wanted to eat more vegetables. That's all they needed. Give them some mutual support.
It's something like I've often thought with UX is like, you know, people fucking lie. And like, how do you overcome that where you like read between the line or phrase the question enough that you don't deal with that?
I'll just say the simple version then and you can expand on that. Is ask the same question three times.
Mm.
Okay.
So the first time, so you're asking people, so UX, how is it we define it? It's an emotional response to a product, system or service. That's like some codified definition of UX that we took off the internet somewhere. Often, if you're talking about a product and you're asking someone how they feel about the product, because it's UX is primarily emotional. Some people like friction, some people don't. It depends on the context, the circumstance, the value that's associated with it. First time you ask them how they feel about it, the initial response is garbage. And then, as Alex said, like, when we create, so we use structured questionnaires. So we'll interrogate, the way the process works with our clients is we'll interrogate the brief, grief. Yes.
slip.
I mean,
that costs way more. Yeah.
Well, we do cause an awful lot of grief by challenging the brief initially, because as we've just been discussing with tech solutions, is it even the right thing? I know you've told me what you want to do, but is that really what you want to do? Because all the stuff that you're asking for doesn't support that need or proposition or outcome. We're not sure it will. Have you really thought about it? Do you really have the resources to deliver upon this idea? So we will interrogate the hell out of it, come up with a straw man proposition, like an idea or hypothesis, and then we'll try and disprove all of the things we're certain about within our hypothesis through a system of qualitative interviews. So this is how we create a benchmark, which can further down the line be tested by quant people. And we look down on quant people. They're very necessary. We'll give them that. But without like an appropriate benchmark, and we're delighted to be proven wrong. Don't get me wrong. Like, or do, in fact. And in doing so, we can work out what the proposition actually is and build the product around that. And if they really want comfort in the title, we'll make sure it's in there, because that's how you do the messaging part, the communications. Because again, communications is user experience. If people don't understand you, you're communicating wrong, or you could be communicating better.
No, 100%. I always love like sitting down with a client and getting to an existential question, like what is comfort, and who are any of us really at the end of the day, and what is communication, and oh God, the crippling anxiety of life. Before we wrap up, I could very happily talk through UX with you guys all day. Just wanted to get any predictions from you all in like what's coming down the line, maybe any of the ways we might start to see common themes throughout UX from, you know, the ongoing AI revolution or any other tech that's coming down the pike that like none of us have really seen yet in your space is moving UX into a different realm of any description.
Or any hopes?
Well, I'd say, actually, I would say less technology would be better. I think that you know, to the point of this whole podcast, technology is important, but are we not just going technology crazy? I love technology. I've been immersed in it. I've been working in social media risk management. I was creating software as a service, but in my previous life, I created a flash mob social network back in the day, things like that. So I really enjoy technology and what it enables you to do. But throughout my career, I've really realized that it's just become a game where we try and just force behaviors onto people. So technology is really powerful, really useful, but we have to use it with a lot more care and attention and respect to people. I think that the message I would send to people is that if you are going to create new things, consider its impact on many, many levels. You know, like just using AI, the amount of power it consumes, you know, all these new cloud services, etc. Where's that energy coming from, etc., etc. You have to really think through your impact before you start creating something that, yes, is cool. Yes, you've got faster deliveries, but how many more scooters have you put on the road? And we might go electric, okay, perhaps, but actually, what is the impact of creating all those electric scooters, etc., etc.? So to come back to pure technology, it's very good, but think about why you're doing it and who you're doing it for, and very, very seriously consider if you're doing it for in the interest of your customers, or are you just trying to create something that's just going to generate lots and lots of money.
So I'm the absolute opposite on AI. I think it's a load of old shite. Like in most applications, like it's unnecessary and it doesn't do a good job. Like it's really good for devaluing the work of a copywriter like yourself, but if you read an AI copy, like it's no good. And the way AI as a product is constructed, and I'm specifically talking like LLM here, because like there's loads of good AI that is out there. So like Google Maps, really canny AI, couldn't live without it. City Mapper, so excellent, brilliant, wonderful. But beyond that, like, man, if AI is learning from the internet, the data sets that train it are human data, and then it starts to learn from AI content on the internet, then you have that entropy which leads to dementia amongst those models, and that's not even accounting for the hallucinations that AI tend to be producing anyway. And if you look at the usage stats, it's already dropping out. Like, it's really useful for some stuff. Throw a bunch of information, it'll throw a PowerPoint back at you.
Right now we spend too much time, we're too in love with data and data sets and trends, etc., and they are very useful, and it's created some amazing companies, unicorns, whatever. But I think the ones in the long term that will really succeed are the ones who are going to be able to create user experiences that are tailored to not quite each individual, but we can be classified as human beings. But the ones who actually start narrowing it and really focusing on them and actually caring, I think will be the ones that will rise above the rest in the future.
This is where we break down what care means.
Exactly. Let's get going. Right. How long have we got? No, 100%. I think it's the people that, like, to your point, kind of break through the malaise of why the fuck is everything the same and not any better than it was, like, in almost every format. And it's just, yeah, that ability to look at the platform and the technology and then combine it with needs rather than just look at the platform and the technology and then not really care about anything else. That's my prediction.
It's a good manifesto.
Well, you're sounding like the apocryphal Luddite. All of a sudden.
Well, such a smaller scale, but it's very much what we do with our marketing campaigns. Like, it's always like, all right, are you sure this is what you actually need? Like, because fucking SEO would do all of this and cost half the price. All right, so, like, and we could roll that out for you. What do your users actually care about? You know, I think the point you raise that we'll almost certainly start doing as an agency is just, has this brief been through a user experience process? Because if not, like, the first call we should have is discussing whether this brief is on point. But yeah, just wrapping us up here, thank you so much for your time. If anyone wants to check out Everything is User Experience, where, or either of you two lovely gentlemen, where can they find you on the interwebs?
So the website is everythingisuserexperience.com, and you can also find us on, well, LinkedIn. And also contact us directly via email if you want to have any questions, or if you have any questions, you're just curious to sort of talk through a problem, a UX problem with us. We're really happy to do that. We do clinics where we just take you through for half an hour, 45 minutes over a problem, and that's either that's a.blondin@eiux.agency, legacy from when we started, and d.hyde@eiux.agency.
I mean, putting the whole proposition in your email handle is a bit too long. I mean, that's another issue. Having just typed in the URL for an application for some innovation group just on the way here, like walking on the street typing that, it's far too long. But we got the .com.
Hey.
If I was William@wetellreallygoodstories.com, like, it's, you're 50-50 which way you're going there. One other thing I'd just for our audience to preview is, you know, we're actually working with Everything as You Experience at the moment on a wonderful white paper that contains a lot of this sort of discussion we've been having of how do you brief properly, how do you truly understand what your users are, and then create stuff for them. So look out for that. We'll be dropping that on social soon.
Thank you so much for coming along.
That's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank it's you been lovely.
Yeah.
So a big thank you to everyone listening today, and an extra big thank you to Dan and Alex, founders of Everything is UX, for joining us. It was a really interesting conversation. We loved having them on. Please share and subscribe to the podcast. And if you're listening on Spotify, then please do give us a rating.
Yep, really appreciate your feedback. So please do share your thoughts as well on the podcast survey in the episode description. If there's anyone you want us to get on, if there's any topics we've not covered, you know, they're very much podcast by the people for the people. So chuck your thoughts in there, and we'll make sure to action them.
I was reading the research the other day, and it turns out that word of mouth is the most important way of spreading the news about podcasts. So just tell one person, just one person. It can be your mom, it can be your dad, it can be anyone else, any family member, a cousin. The dog walker, just share with one person.
You having a good day? Tell fucking two people.
Two? Oh.
Tell two. Yeah, tell two. You having a bad day? Tell three. I don't know, I got really close to the mic for that.
And it was really intense.
Yeah, it was really intense. Like, I was threatening people.
We're firing the booth moment.
Yeah.
Firing the booth.
We're going to include this in the intro. What would your rap name be for Fire in the Booth?
My rap name?
What would you go with?
MC Savatron.
MC Savatron.
Wow.
You laugh,
fuck,
but give me 5 years, I'll be there.
Oh, mate, I've got nothing to talk for. Have you got anything that can beat MC Savatron?
I mean, I just, whenever people ask me a DJ name, I just say Black Americano. It's like black coffee, but like, not quite.
I think I might riff on that, and I'd be like, disappointing latte.
Wow.
Weak latte. Cool.
So, yeah, this has been MC Savatron.
This has been Weak Latte.
Black Americano signing out.